For instance, men who say they want a long-term relationship do much better than men looking for an occasional lover. But women looking for an occasional lover do great. For men, a woman's looks are of paramount importance. For women, a man's income is terribly important. The richer a man is, the more emails he receives. But a woman's income appeal is a bell-shaped curve. Men do not want to date low-earning women, but once a woman starts earning too much, men seem to be scared off. Men want to date students, artists, musicians, veterinarians, and celebrities, while avoiding secretaries, retirees, and women in the military and law enforcement. Women do want to date military men, policemen, and firemen, possibly the result of a 9/11 effect, like the higher payments to Paul Feldman's bagel business, as well as lawyers and financial executives. Women avoid laborers, actors, students, and men who work in food services or hospitality. For men, being short is a big disadvantage, which is probably why so many lie about it. But weight doesn't much matter. For women, being overweight is deadly, which is probably why they lie. For a man, having red hair or curly hair is a downer, as is baldness, but a shaved head is okay. For a woman, salt and pepper hair is bad, while blonde hair is very good. In the world of online dating, a head full of blonde hair on a woman is worth about the same as having a college degree. And, with a $100 dye job versus a $100,000 tuition bill, an awful lot cheaper. In addition to all the information about income, education, and looks, men and women on the dating site also listed their race. Furthermore, they were asked to indicate a preference regarding the race of their potential dates. The two preferences were, quote, the same as mine, or, quote, it doesn't matter. Like the contestants on The Weakest Link, the website users were now publicly declaring how they felt about people who didn't look like them. They would act on their actual preferences later, in confidential emails to the people they wanted to date. Roughly half of the white women on the site and 80% of the white men declared that race didn't matter to them. But the response data tell a different story. The white men who said that race didn't matter sent 90% of their email queries to white women. The white women who said race didn't matter sent about 97% of their email queries to white men. Is it possible that race really didn't matter for these white women and men, and that they simply never happened to browse a non-white date that interested them? Or, more likely, did they say that race didn't matter because they wanted to come across, especially to potential mates of their own, as open-minded? The gulf between the information we publicly proclaim and the information we know to be true is often vast, or, put a more familiar way, we say one thing and do another. This can be seen in personal relationships, in commercial transactions, and, of course, in politics. By now, we are fully accustomed to the false public proclamations of politicians themselves. But voters lie, too. Consider an election between a black candidate and a white candidate. Might white voters lie to pollsters, claiming they will vote for the black candidate in order to appear more colorblind than they actually are? Apparently so. In New York City's 1989 mayoral race between David Dinkins, a black candidate, and Rudolph Giuliani, who is white, Dinkins won by only a few points. Although Dinkins became the city's first black mayor, his slender margin of victory came as a surprise, for pre-election polls showed Dinkins winning by nearly 15 points. When the white supremacist David Duke ran for the U.S. Senate in 1990, he garnered nearly 20% more of the vote than pre-election polls had projected, an indication that thousands of Louisiana voters did not want to admit their preference for a candidate with racist views. Duke, though he never won the high political office he sought, proved himself a master of information abuse. As Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, he was able to compile a mailing list of thousands of rank-and-file Klansmen and other supporters who would eventually become his political base. Not content to use the list only for himself, He sold it for $150,000 to the governor of Louisiana. Years later, Duke would once again use the list himself, letting his supporters know that he'd fallen on hard times and needed their donations. In this way, Duke was able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for his continuing work in the field of white supremacy. He had explained to his supporters in a letter that he was so broke that the bank was trying to repossess his house. In truth, Duke had already sold his house for a solid profit. It isn't known whether he used a real estate agent. And most of the money he raised from his supporters was being used not to promote any white supremacist cause, but rather to satisfy Duke's gambling habit. It was a sweet little scam he was running until he was arrested and sent to federal prison in Big Spring, Texas. From the New York Times Magazine. Levitt fits everywhere and nowhere. He is a noetic butterfly that no one has pinned down. He was once offered a job on the Clinton economic team, and the 2000 Bush campaign asked him about being a crime advisor, but who is claimed by all. He has come to be acknowledged as a master of the simple, clever solution. He is the guy who, in the slapstick scenario, sees all the engineers futzing with a broken machine and then realizes that no one had thought to plug it in.